This week in the markets, U.S. shares and precious metals rallied on lessening trade war tensions. Well, welcome back to GoldSeek.com Radio, everyone. Your host, Chris Walczyk. It's just great to be with you on this Season 14, Episode 687 show, Precious Metals. Investors enjoyed another solid week, so it's a pleasure to offer all of our listeners a free $5 in one gold digital blockchain gold. That's exclusively to our GoldSeek.com patrons. Remember to say GoldSeek Radio sent you. There's a link there and a drop-down box for you to do so. We have the links up on the webpage. So just stop by and pick up your $5 free digital gold. The CEO of One Gold, Kenneth Lewis, returns to the show. Their metals and their blockchain are backed by the Royal Canadian Mint through Atmex and Sprott. Shares all kinds of neat aspects of this amazing story. After just 3 months, they already have $2 million under management. The average size order is around $1,500, and it typically ships the same day if you want to convert your digital into physical precious metals. Then Bob Hoy, editor and chief investment strategist of chartsandmarkets.com, rejoins the show with all kinds of insights on just what's going on in the markets. He takes a look at the manias, bubbles, and financial peaks and crashes of the past and tries to make some sense of all the volatility we're seeing in our markets today. Nobody can do it like Bob Hoy. And it's a real pleasure to say that he and Ross Clark are getting excited about gold and silver shares after being bearish for quite some time. Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest report, and we'd like for you to call into our Q&A hotline, 641-715-3900, followed by extension number 5140-49. GoldSeek.com begins now with a market weather recap. Sunny skies persisted over the precious metals sector this week as investors dumped U.S. dollars for the euro currency on speculation of higher rates from the EU ministers. At Friday's closing bell, the precious metals indices finished near break even, with the yellow metal up just $3.60 around 1303. Silver also finished near break even at 1532. But the XAU precious metals shares finished around 76, very little upward movement there as well. Black gold, though, bucked the trend, picking up 250, about 4.5% at $58 a barrel. That's about $16 above the lows a few months ago. Palladium stole the show, finishing at a new all-time record weekly close of 1518 an ounce, a couple hundred dollars above gold. This, of course, the story that's, or at least the rumor, Chinese economic stimulus will boost their domestic auto demand, which will send, of course, demand for catalytic metals sky high. At least that's the rumor. Plus, Russia may ban exports on precious metals scraps. Pretty solid supplier of palladium. And sister metal platinum added $14, about 2% this week, looking really good at $8.32. The top story driving the metals higher this week: investors cheered positive developments on a truce in the trade war between U.S. and its top trading partner, China. A key Chinese news agency reported representatives from Beijing and Washington made solid progress on the trade war. The Chinese premier said Beijing was open to additional monetary stimulus measures to boost economic growth. Bottom line on precious metals: well, investors dumped the greenback this week in favor of the euro. It's clear the Fed rate hike cycle now is finished completely. If we look at the Fed funds futures, we will not see a rate hike next week, nor will we anytime this year or maybe into next year, 2020. Plus, we saw solid durable goods numbers and wholesale inflation in goods and services within the producer price index, which suggests the domestic economic conditions are likely more hot than expected. Turning to the Wall Street Report, visibility virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange this week as investors bought up shares on positive developments in the trade war narrative. By Friday's closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow picked up about 400 points, 1.5%, finishing at 25,848. Meanwhile, the S&P 500 added 80 points, 3%, at 28,22, and the Nasdaq picked up 280 points, 4%, ending at 76,88. Meanwhile, as the euro currency continues to soar, breaking out this week against the dollar, the Federal Reserve meeting next week is likely to indicate the Federal Reserve is not expected to raise rates, as I mentioned next week. The current Fed funds futures suggest virtually no odds of a rate hike into 2020. In fact, there are zero bets in the early 2020 contract for any higher rate. So it looks like that rate hike cycle is donezo Parsons. Plus the Bank of Japan on Friday, U.S. shares bottom line. Well, the USA Today Greed to Fear Index continues to settle down a bit. I think that from a technical position, things look very solid. We should consolidate for a while and perhaps make another assault on new highs in 2019. One note, though, of caution, Jim Cramer of CNBC turned surprisingly bearish this week. He says that it's best to own index funds. That's the best exposure. And, of course, he's on record now for calling for 1,400 and 1,500 gold. So interesting development there. More Gold Seek coming up after this.
Just a real pleasure to welcome back CEO of One Gold and AppMax to give us the latest updates, Kenneth Lewis.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate the time.
It's great to have you. And, you know, before we start off, quick overview of One Gold for our newer listeners.
I'm going to just go back a little bit in time here. And you know, AppMax is a 19-plus-year-old company that really is the infrastructure behind One Gold. AppMax, as many people probably know, I believe the largest online seller of precious metals in the world. We deal in physical. We've got over 1 million customers. We've done more than $10 billion in business. We're a trusted partner who puts our customers first. And we frankly sat down about a year ago, and we were watching what was going on in the crypto space. But I felt like there were some good merits in crypto that I thought could really be powerful down the road. And so what we did was we sat down with a couple of technology partners and with Sprott up in Canada. Sprott is an investor in the One Gold product with us. And we all kind of put our heads together and said, why don't we build an online platform for consumers to take ownership in metal that has all the conveniences of a crypto space, but allows you to have real metal back in your investment, allows you to do things like link your bank account, do continuity programs, where you can invest every week or every day, and just make it simple. And then most importantly, if you want to take physical, you know, redeem your digital for physical anytime you want. So that was really kind of what the goal was, and we've made some good progress on trying to make that a reality.
You know, we're big believers in the blockchain and, of course, the transparency that it brings, the digital aspects of it. The precious metals crowd, it's more traditional, physical, tangible, laissez-faire, hands-off by the government type of security with your wealth. Can you bring One Gold into that narrative?
You know, I think it's a great question and it's a great point. Like I said, I'm a big believer in physical. I own physical myself. AppMax does $1 billion a year in physical. We don't expect digital to replace physical. But what I will say, go out and look at the investment in ETFs. Look at how much money people are putting into paper positions in metal. And all you have to do is look at the size of that market and say, what if we could build a product that allows you to have all the benefits of an ETF, but know that it's always physically backed, and the blockchain verifies that, and the Royal Canadian Mint, our partner on a couple of products, stands behind the inventory being there at all times. So you have a government entity actually telling you your gold's here. You know, that's a huge deal to us. And if you can do that at a cost structure and a convenience that's better than ETFs, why wouldn't people give it a shot? So the crowd we're going after are those who believe in paper investments of gold, who believe in a position of metal, but maybe doesn't necessarily want to have all of that metal sitting in their home, you know, under lock and key. That's why we built it. And frankly, you know, it's going to probably take years. Maybe it never gets to the size of our physical demand, and we're perfectly fine with that. But we do think long term, the blockchain, the low cost of ownership, the instant liquidity, they're going to be things that people are going to want, and we wanted to be the guy that brought that to market.
So I'd like to transition, if we could, into some of the deposit options that you have. I mean, obviously you have a lot of convenient ways for people to get involved. You've got checks, ACH, bank wires, bank transfers, credit cards, PayPal, and even Bitcoin.
Well, what we wanted to do is appeal to the masses. It's important to note that a lot of cryptos, and frankly, a lot of these new applications out there, require you to fund any purchase before you actually can place the purchase. When we built One Gold, we built it where you had your choice of that. You could fund it up front, or you can actually execute your transaction, lock in your price and your purchase, and then submit your funds after the transaction. A very, very important differentiation, we think, in what we built. But when it comes to payment methods, I'll tell you, the one that's blown me away, the broader masses are embracing this, is the bank account option. You tend to think of a precious metal buyer being very conservative, and the last thing you think they would do is maybe link their bank account to an online platform like One Gold. Believe it or not, 50% of our customers are linking their bank accounts for the convenience factor of moving cash. Really surprised us greatly. PayPal, you can actually physically mail in a check if you like to. It's very common in our industry. People like to deal in checks. No problem. We made that a possibility for you. So it's really about giving you convenience, allowing you to deal and handle the process any way you feel comfortable. Giving those options was important to us when we built this.
No, exactly, and you have a lot of options for folks here. I mean, let's talk a little bit about your vaulting partners and some of these other ways that you – these metrics you have that you've included in your literature.
Yeah, you know, one of the things, it's a couple of things. First and foremost, it's important that you know that your metal's there and you're protected. And so initially, we've worked with the Royal Canadian Mint. They actually have metal throughout multiple processes within their operation. And so what we've done is we actually buy metal from banks. We buy it from wholesalers that's sitting at the Royal Canadian Mint. It's allocated metal. And the Mint actually, the Royal Canadian Mint actually updates the blockchain to reflect my ownership interest. So I can't actually sell any metal that I don't already own. It's impossible. The blockchain will blow up and not allow me to do it. And with the Royal Canadian Mint, obviously, you're not going to have any concerns there. You have the government of Canada standing behind it. So hopefully consumers can feel comfortable. What it's not is this. It's not a safe sitting behind my desk where I'm holding some gold bars, which in some cases, when you start to research things, you may find. And so we try to make sure people have complete protection at all times. But when it comes to some metrics, I'll tell you, it's blown us away. 80-plus countries, people have actually signed up for an account on One Gold. 29 countries they've actually transacted from. 28% of our transactions are reoccurring transactions, meaning they've gone out and said, I want $10 in gold every week and set that up for the next 6 months. So they get the dollar cost averaging benefit of the tool. Just some really amazing numbers. The average order value is over $1,500. So this isn't people just, you know, dinking in here and dropping in $20. They're actually coming in here and doing fairly large transactions. And we've already got north of $2 million under management, and we've only been live for 3 months. So we think we're onto something. The dollars are still small in the scheme of Atmex, but I think it's definitely something that consumers are responding very well to.
Yeah, I'd say hat tip for all that. You really sparked the gray matter. I mean, even these small transactions, it adds up. People are benefiting. I love the idea of dollar cost averaging. I mean, it's really just the only surefire bet to win in the markets for the everyday. I mean, there's professionals out there, but for most of us, that's the best way. Let's move on now to the redemption aspect. People can convert their digital metals into physical and have it delivered to their home. Tell us more, please.
It's actually pretty neat. When we went out and we researched the market, there are a couple products out there. Their fees were a little heavy, but none of them made redemption easy. What they do is they try to make it difficult for you to actually convert to physical. They'll say they'll do it, but then you got to get on the phone and you got to listen to a salesperson and you got to go through this whole rigmarole. What we did was we actually put on the site right there for you to convert to physical anytime you want. And actually what it does is kind of neat. When you add it to your cart, it allows you then to pick how you want to pay for the purchase. And your options to pay for it are with your digital metal, or you can actually pay with it for some other payment method as well. We give the consumers, because we know redemption is important. The volume we do on redemption is pretty small, but just having the ability to do redemption is very important to our consumers. And so what we've done also is given them best pricing for each of the products. So what that means is when you go to Atmex and you want to buy 100 Gold Eagles, you'll get a great price. It's a little bit more expensive if you buy one. If you go on to One Gold and you want to convert, we'll give you our best price, even if it's for One Gold Eagle. So we just want to make sure people know we're stand behind it. We're going to make sure you're taken care of. Convert to physical anytime you want, at any time, 24/7. And also what's really nice is we pretty much guarantee, I can't guarantee it depending on the time of day, but if your order's in before 3 o'clock, challenge me on it, your order probably will ship same day. So we don't sit there and hold the order for a week, go buy the inventory and do all that stuff. Atmex has over $100 million in inventory sitting in our vaults. We ship that product same day, and you're going to have that product very quickly to your home.
I can speak to this. If you get a product shipped within 30 days for many services, yeah, you're doing really well. So before we wrap up, I think you did touch on the ECN. You've touched on the Royal Canadian Mint. You've talked about this as being fully audited. It's 100% sure. Metal backed.
I think the one thing that I would encourage anyone to do is just try it. You know, go out, put $5 in silver, see how easy it is to use. And I'm actually going to give an offer to your listeners. When they go to One Gold, we're going to ask you, how'd you hear about us? If you just select the podcast on GoldSeek, we're going to give you $5 in metal just to allow you to play with it. Because what we're finding is, the feedback is overwhelmingly positive. Matter of fact, it's hard to find anything that's not positive right now once someone uses it. So we're going to give the listeners $5 to go play with the tool. There's a little catch. You got to eventually fund it with $100 or more to get the $5 out. But I want you just to try it out. Go in, put GoldSeek down there as where you heard us, heard from us, and try it out. You know, inch your way into it and see if it meets your needs. But I'll tell you, I'm a big believer in the technology, the tool. I'm a big believer in owning precious metals, and I'm sure many of your listeners are. I think you're going to find some of the advantages of a digital presence over an ETF to be pretty significant.
They need to get their toes in the water. I'm always trying to encourage some of my folks. You know, they're not really familiar with cryptos yet. Give them, like you say, $5, $10, even $100 in Bitcoin. Let them kick it around. You know, see what this is all about, right? Folks are going to eat this up. Bring all the runners across home plate.
You know, just again, like I said, just give it a run. I'm never going to talk anyone out of owning physical because I still think that's a viable option. But if you're really thinking about wanting a broader presence of metals, hedging your portfolio further, considering an ETF, give it a run. You're going to be impressed. Security on this platform is top notch. It's two-factor authorization, email confirmation. All your login histories, all they're visible for you, so you know at all times the activity in your account. I think your consumers are going to be very impressed, and I'm hopeful that they'll give it a run because what we've seen is those who transact on the site, they do 3 times more transactions on One Gold than they do when they buy physical. It's just that easy to use. So give it a shot, and I really do appreciate it, Chris.
Pleasure's ours. And again, if any folks are just getting acquainted, if you will, with 2FN, with a two-factor authorization, just fire me over some emails. Let me help you set up, you know, a Google G-Auth or something like that and make sure that you're comfortable with the security. Because let me tell you, once you have solid security, you won't want to go back to just regular password protection. Kenneth Lewis, pleasure having you here, and let's talk again 2019.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
The blockchain revolution is transforming the global arena, disrupting every industry in its path. GoldSeek.com is excited to introduce an off-the-chain opportunity in digital gold and silver from our friends at Atmex and Sprott.com. One Gold holds physical gold and silver metals at the Royal Canadian Mint, the first online marketplace to offer secure and convenient buying, selling, and redemption of digital precious metals. One Gold uses Vault Chain, a secure, immutable blockchain ledger developed by TradeWind Markets, the leading innovator in digital precious metals distributed ledger and blockchain technology. Vault Chain. Gold and silver are 100% redeemable through One Gold for physical precious metals delivered to customers' doors in any size at competitive prices and low transaction storage costs. As a special offer and for a limited time only, One Gold is offering gold and silver at spot price with no additional premium. OneGold.com is secure and accessible 24/7 on any device, offering convenient purchases and sales of precious metals. Easy recurring transactions make passive saving and gold dollar cost averaging as easy as a single mouse click. Vault Chain offers the best tier pricing on AppMex products, setting the industry standard as a fully backed physical asset with easy redemption in coins, rounds, or bars, offering clients peace of mind and full transparency. Don't get left behind. Remember to bookmark OneGold.com for the safest and most convenient digital precious metals today. Remember, One Gold. GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
It's just a big pleasure to welcome back, really a favorite here on GoldSeek.com radio for many years, formerly of Institutional Advisors. Now he runs a new site with his one of his colleagues there, Bob Clark. And it's just a pleasure to welcome him back to the show on another volatile week in the markets. Hello, Bob.
Good to be with you, Chris, and also good to be with our listeners. The hit, you know, down into December was very significant because prior to that, it had been a fabulous bubble. And we have ways of identifying those because a long time ago, I got interested in financial history and then went looking for bubbles. We knew about most, you know, it was well written about the 1720 South Sea bubble. And then, of course, everybody knew about the 1929 bubble. And then you had this recurring, you know, commodity booms. So back then I thought, oh, well, there must be other financial bubbles in between. So I take me out to the stacks in the library at the University of British Columbia and started going. And sure, then you found a reference to the great big bubble of 1873, and then one in 1825. So then I photographed or photocopied pages from books and diaries and journals, also from economic history journals, that sort of stuff, and put a file, 1825. And what I ended up with, files all the way back to 1315 on financial crisis. So here we are with a whole history of these things, and they are, at least since the advent of a stock bubble, which was in 1720, they're quite regular. We can say that in London that there were enough stocks in the 1660s to be the beginning of a stock market, and by the 1670s there was enough traders, you know, involved to call it a stock market. The first in English market letter was written by a guy by the name of Houghton, and he started in 1692. And then, of course, the modern world of finance had started in 1694 with the formation of the Bank of England. And it was a something-for-nothing promotion that just the concept of the Bank of England, and one of the promoters said it would infallibly lower interest rates. So it's a dream world thing. And then for a long period, the Bank of England, when it was on a gold standard, and that made, of course, the English currency on a gold standard, it was about as good as you can get. And then it all went to hell after that. But the main thing is that the pattern from the conclusion of a great bubble has been remarkably similar. You have a long expansion in business around the world, and it culminates with a big rush of speculation in commodities, like 1920. And then that burns itself out and it crashes. And then during the 1920s, the Federal Reserve, which was then just a youthful organization, was very concerned about weak commodity prices, which then induced poor pricing pressure in most business and stuff like that. So the Fed was easy during the mid-1920s, and the guys at the Fed didn't have a clue about a financial bubble. And it was building and building, and then finally went crazy and concluded in September 1929, 9 years after the big blowout in commodities. So then I got interested in that one, and sure enough, you go back to the first bubble in 1720, and you get a commodity index or consumer price index, and it had a huge high in 1711. So this one repeated each time. I was able to find a commodity index to the month through and back to 1920s. And so if you then got the peak in commodities in 1920 to the month, and of course we know that the peak in the stock market was early September of 29, and you count it out, it was 9 years and 5 months. So then with our perhaps late bubble, and if you take the New York Stock Exchange composite, which is a really broad index, it peaked in January of 2018. And then if you take the world index of stocks without the U.S. in it, it peaked in January 2018. So then if you take that with the huge commodity boom that concluded in June of 2008, and we'll all remember crude oil up at $147. So that count from that peak in commodities to January 2018 is 9 years and 7 months, which is really quite remarkable how financial history can replicate previous and very significant events. Now, here's where it gets really interesting, is that each of those great bubbles, when it finally broke and collapsed, led to a long credit and economic contraction, except for one, the one that followed the 1872 bubble, and who knows about that. But four out of five examples ended up in a long contraction. So what we can say now is that each of the bubbles ended with a liquidity crisis in the fall of the year where you had the most excitement in the markets. And this is what we used then last summer to point out that credit markets, yield curve, credit spreads, and industrial commodities were following the pattern that would lead to a conclusion somewhere after August. And then in citing this economic history, noted that the liquidity prices would probably be in the fall. And one example, 1825, the panic continued right into Christmas. So that was our projection for the last part of the year. A liquidity crisis, and perhaps running as late as Christmas. And of course, the worst day was December 24th, when the S&P, we had downside capitulations and a sequential buy for the S&P, and also the same thing for crude oil, because they were panicking together. So then we were looking for a rebound out until around March. And this is what we've been getting, and this would also include industrial commodities and credit spreads and the yield curve acting favorably, which they have. So to go back to last year, we put this, ages ago, we put this package together of indicators, and we called them the friends of the bull market. Then last year, the friends of the bull market would likely be friendly until mid-year and then possibly change. But on this rebound, it more than likely is a rally following a great financial bubble. So we're calling those indicators the friends of the rally, because I don't think it's a new bull market. And at the end of February, well, actually it was February 21st, our indicators, which were so good to us last year, again got very overbought, sequential sales, all that sort of thing. So somewhere we would call, we were looking for a correction, and you had a pretty good hit and down, and we'll get another bounce here. So, Chris, in order to be really dispassionate and clinical about this, there's no question that all of the characteristics of a great financial bubble were there and completed last year. There's also no question that there was a pretty good liquidity panic going into late in the year. And then this is a rebound, but you won't know until the lows of December are taken out before you can really declare that it's a bear market. And then again, of course, the other way, if somehow they're able to get this up to new highs, then you've got to look at the probability that it might be another new bull market. But you would look for slowing business activity in England and Europe. Asia is important. China's important. And things have been slowing down. In England, the London Interbank rate, LIBOR, it had its high in December, and for its interest rate, and it seems to be coming down. So there are a number of signs suggesting that the world is beginning to change following a very, very huge financial bubble.
Firstly, let's address the potential for either a bull or a bear market. I like that with your service, you keep an open mind that we're not sure. We don't know if we have higher highs. Well, we may have to reassess the situation if we break the lows of late last year in the primary U.S. equities markets. Well, you know, we may be looking at 2008-style meltdown or worse. And also, you bring up bubbles. Bubbles. These bubbles, did they typically involve a paper market? Were we not looking at a gold-backed monetary system? And even if we were, was it a, had they let the paper money, you know, out of the bag? Because you went as far back as 1300, if memory serves.
Oh, well, that was, crises, credit crises, but not stock bubbles. But there's a good example with the first one, the South Sea bubble in England in 1720. And England was on a bimetallic standard then. But over in Paris, you had John Law with his Banque Royale going to replace gold and silver currency strictly with his banknotes. So he was, you could say, the first very reckless central banker. And they had a magnificent stock bubble, absolutely incredible, because he was printing. I think there was something like 7 or 8 printing presses in Paris, just printing banknotes. And it blew out in 1720 and crashed. And then the public figured it out pretty soon, and they wanted to see the printing plates for the currency smashed and broken, and John Law was lucky to get out of the country. He had to sneak out, otherwise they would have strung him up. But in England, of course, you were on a bimetallic standard, so the Bank of England couldn't print. But it didn't matter because those participating in the markets were perfectly capable of creating credit, where one company was lending money to another, or one person was. And so you had a magnificent bubble in stocks, and it occurred within the constraint of a gold standard in London. And then you had a magnificent bubble in stocks, paper, as it occurred in Paris, with the printing presses going like mad. Both came to an end, and you went into contraction. So And then, of course, in England, through, let's see, the bubble, 1825, they had been off of gold for 9 years, get back on in 1820. But that bubble occurred on a gold standard, as did the 1873 example. 1929 bubble, you can't say whether they were, they'd gone off of gold in 1926 and then back on at a different price. I mean, it was all, and also you were getting into the world of economists where they began to corrupt the bankers within the central bank. So, but history provides an example of a big bubble, whether the currency was on gold or not. And, the good example was the 1873 bubble as it occurred in...
Yeah, railroad stock bubble. Go ahead.
Oh, incredible. But in any bubble, as it's approaching a peak, the credit strains are there. You've got the yield curve inverted and credit spreads narrowing crazily, and there's a strain that any experienced financial guy is going to sense. So New York had one of their important newspapers, the Herald, in 1873, and during that summer when strains were becoming invisible, there was an editorial that pointed out that in the U.S., that while the financial markets were stretched, that nothing could go wrong. And the reason was carefully explained is because the U.S. did not have a central bank constrained by gold. It had it's called either Treasury system or the national banking system. And the editorial went on that the Treasury system could issue liquidity, like banknotes, endlessly because it wasn't a central bank constrained by gold. So the reason why the 1873 bubble, that nothing could go wrong, is because the U.S. did not have a central bank and was not on a gold standard, and the market went up, peaked in September of 1873, and crashed. That bear market lasted for 5 years, and one of the good stock index, somebody decades ago created an S&P index for 1871, 72, 73, and they must have just put some dull trading senior stocks in it because it doesn't show any bubble. But if you look at, there's an index of mines and smelting stocks. Well, they went up, 500. And then within about 15 years, that index was down to about 25. So it was a fabulous bull market and a fabulous crash and a long contraction. But in England was the senior economy then, and that contraction was quite severe. And this with, first of all, the initial bear market and the initial recession, and then a weak recovery and then more recession. So the economic numbers weren't good. And senior economists in England in 1884 began to call it the Great Depression. And that Great Depression ran until 1895, 1896, that last recession, and then it sort of cleared and started to head up again. But the senior economists in England, as late as 1939, were still analyzing the Great Depression, how it could have been prevented and stuff like that. And that what they were meaning, the 1873 to 1895 Great Depression. And then, oops, hey, there's a real depression here now. But in the U.S. was a little different. They had their swings in business cycle, bull and bear markets, but the U.S. was experiencing what China has been doing. It was a huge migration from rural to city, and a tremendous expansion of industrial capacity, where the U.S. went from 5% of global industrial production to about 20%. So remarkable things were going on, but nonetheless, you still had business cycles and bear markets and whatnot. But but where England had an older economy, as did Northern Europe, it went into a long contraction. So this has been fascinating to review when I was doing it years ago, and it's now absolutely incredible to watch it working out.
You have this almost cyclical pattern throughout history, and you know we've only covered two of Mackay's three bubbles, and of course the tulip mania. We've missed out on the Dutch tulip mania. So again, sort of returning to my last question, in your opinion, wouldn't you agree that those three bubbles, as well as the 1929 collapse, were all predicated on money printing? Was there not some degree of paper scheme involved in all?
The 1637 tulips was a local phenomenon, and it was at the bottom of a long contraction.
Bob, they did have a tulip futures.
They were called in on chalkboards in taverns and stuff, and the financial authorities, C16, that would have been Amsterdam, warned the public that this is not through the usual clearing system, so you may have problems settling contracts and problems. So it was all warned, but it was a unique bubble, a mania where the public came in and created credit out of nowhere. And it was not based upon currency depreciation. As a matter of fact, it was the bottom of a depression when you had had a long period of currency picking up power because of the long period of weakening prices. So prompted credit expansion. This is where I have problem with the guys, the Austrians and the von Mises people. They can only see cause and effect whereby you expand credit, and that pushes prices up. And that ain't so. You got to look at all of this history. And it's always and inevitably that rising prices brings on the leverage, and that creates the credit. So it's prices rising that allows the credit expansion. And it's not credit expansion that pushes prices up.
That's interesting. Yeah, and there would be plenty of folks in the audience that would probably take issue with that.
I'd love to debate an Austrian or a Mises or a Hayek guy on this, or Rothbard. I mean,
what's really going on there is that more than likely most of the premises that they're basing their work on are correct. It just takes such a long time for a system like this in place to self-right, you know, self-correct.
Yeah, the lag idea is always in there, but no, I think there's the first, when I mentioned that you had two the bubbles in France and the bubble in England, one was on solid currency convertible and one was on paper, and they both did the same thing. So the phenomenon is on its own. And then you've had like as I said, the pattern has been huge speculation in global commodities. You know, in 1920, the U.S. rate of inflation got up to 22%. In 1980, where inflation was the bugbear, got up to 14%. You had a central bank in the U.S. in the 1920s. So the Mises, Austrian school says that it was Fed easing that drove prices up. So then why, if the Fed was easing during the 19-teens, why then did commodity prices come down? They got overbought and crashed. And then the Fed was easy through the 1920s, hoping to push basic commodity prices up. Now, let's go back to the Obama administration, where the Fed was concerned that they had to get the rate of CPI inflation above 2% or something awful would happen. So through this late bubble, it was the same compulsion, the Fed easing, trying to boost commodity prices. And instead, the public boosted up stock prices. And this is critical to the argument, Chris, is the public chooses what will be speculated in. The central bankers, with their theories, are innocent of knowledge about the public speculating in financial items, and then they learn about it too late. So, no deliberate credit expansion by a central bank does not drive prices up. It's the public speculating first in commodities that allows that credit expansion, and then it crashes, and then the public swings over to speculating in financial items, and then that then goes to completion and crashes. Now, there's a simpler way of describing this, is that when they're speculating in commodities, they're hoarding tangible assets. Then they get burned out on that, and then they switch over to hoarding of financial assets. And then the public gets burned out on that, and they then hoard cash. So that's why in the 1930s, in that contraction, the economists were going crazy, because they figured, well, and the Fed was easy in late 1929 and 1930, but it wasn't working. So, I mean, a matter of fact, in a July 1932 Barron's, when that was the end of that first bear market, the editorial in Barron's was noting that no matter how many bonds the Fed has been buying, that the deflation remained relentless. So there's a few evidences that the Fed was easy all through that contraction. But it wasn't until the 1960s that the new school of macroeconomics, which needed the instrument of the Fed, that they then started talking about how perfect the Fed was, and then criticizing the guys who were running the Fed in 1929, 1930. And that then is an ad hominem argument. So, but here we are again. You've had, through the last decade, the Fed being worried about weakening prices. Remember, they had to keep inflation above 2%. And in the 1920s, the Fed worrying about weakening prices, and you ended up with stock bubble. And then every stock bubble in history, once completed, it has ended up in a serious contraction. So this is what's ahead of us. And Chris, I like to use a sort of a probability argument. And the path, the financial speculation has run a typical path. As I said, 9 years, 7 months from a peak in commodity speculation, and to 1929, it was 9 years, 5 months. Well, hell, your accuracy is only a month. So the this has worked out. So then you can say that there is no guarantee that the pattern will continue to work out. But there's no guarantee that the pattern will not work out. And so you say, what are the odds? And the odds are, five out of five great bubbles in the past ended up in immediate hard hit to the stock market and a contraction. So it's the longer term. So this is, I think that's wise, that There is no guarantee that it will continue to work out, but then there is no guarantee that it won't. And you got to remember that the guy's running the show now, supposedly at the Federal Reserve, they don't know anything more about stock speculation than the bankers who were running the Federal Reserve in 1929. They were oblivious to it. They were concerned about keeping prices, commodity prices, from falling.
I think one of the key takeaways that I hope everyone else picked up on here is that, you know, there's a interplay between financial assets, commodities, and cash. And you might say that these are the three hideouts for wealth, right? Let's fast forward to today. There's a new hideout. Cryptocurrencies, the blockchain revolution.
Sure, okay? It's cash. It's a cash item.
Money flows, do we not, all over the world at the speed of light practically. We never had that before. Can you bring all this together in terms of the modern economy?
You're not going to like this one, Chris. 1873, bubble. And in New York, the view was that if there is a crisis, then we can get immediate liquidity from London via wires because they had the transatlantic cable. So before the crash, there could be no problem because they could get immediate liquidity from London. This was, of course, beyond the liquidity that the Treasury system would provide. After the crash, one of the stories was that, it was instantaneous communication that did us in. So you mentioned instantaneous communication.
Because we all recall, you know, Edwin LeFave's classic in Livermore. I mean, they were using ticker tape way back in the day, well over 100, 120 years. Still, we've got to talk about that blockchain revolution because what an interesting and intriguing hideout that might be for deep pockets if the stuff hits the oscillating device.
Yeah. Okay, you want to look, cash is gold or silver coins. Often called specie, gold bars, and it's gold. So gold plays an important part in this because during the financial bubble, and what I did ages ago was just to take the price of gold and deflate it by the CPI in the senior currency starting in 1700. And then this is where then the data tells you what's going on, and what's going on is that on each of those great bubbles in the final few years of the bubble, the real price of gold went down. So then gold stocks underperformed, if not being a disaster. The real price of industrial commodities went up, like copper, so then you would then have really good action in base metal stocks. So, but here you are then. After the bubble, everything falls in price relative to gold. So gold's real price has gone up in the first two or three years after a bubble during the contraction. Because it's money. And in a bubble, when you've got the S&P going up, tripling, the amount of S&P you can buy with a dollar declines by a factor of three. So you got to understand that a bubble in stock prices is the currency depreciating in stock prices or against copper, for example. And then when you're in a contraction, the purchasing of all these prices of S&P and copper and hotels and real estate and everything else come down, your purchasing power of money is going up. So then the real, and it shows up in the real price of gold. For example, in the 1929 bubble, in U.S. terms, the price was convertible, or the dollar was convertible at $20.67 an ounce. And with the boom and cost going up and the price of gold not going up, you had your premier producer then was Homestake, and the Homestake stock underperformed the general market, and their earnings went down. I haven't got the chart in front of me now, but they might have even reported a loss in 1929. But then beginning in 1930, their earnings started to come back, and I believe it was a mine in constant production. And their, because their costs came down, the base metal mining shut down, so then you had miners were available. Cost of energy came down. The cost of blasting agents came down. So that then Homestake stock by the end of 1932 was up something like 130% from its low. And also their earnings were up in that order. You know, I haven't got it in front of me, Chris, but like 130%. And there was no change in the price of gold. Still $20.67 an ounce. And this is, of course, when the stock market was crashing. So the gold sector became the premier place to be, and it was real, extremely real, because I think the way it works is that when you have a boom, a stock boom, all leverage, of course, credit is important in it. And then also there's a tendency for the street to invent new credit products, derivatives and things like that, or the equivalent going way back. So then suddenly discovery is that this stuff is worthless and you get credit marked down in price. So there's that's why it's called a credit contraction, a tremendous credit contraction. But with the real price going up of gold, the producers are making more money at it, so they expand production. And, of course, gold gets into the banking system, and even in today's world of intellectual economists hating gold. So this is how the system gets liquid again. So as the contraction's going on, the real price of gold goes up, the miners produce more, and it gets into the banking system. And this has been reliable for 300 years, and on the near term, as I said, that in the final few years of a bubble, and all five of them, and now this sixth one, the real price has gone down, and over the last year, it looks like the real price of gold in U.S. terms is turning up. As a matter of fact, last month, it rose above the downtrend line, but hasn't broken out yet. This is fitting history. And so as the real price goes up, more miners will be producing it, and it creates liquidity. And also it's a blessing for exploration stocks too, Chris, because it comes down to economic and geological valuation of these properties. And if the real price is going up, then that enhances the valuation of the properties, and then you get action in exploration stocks. So we're going into, let's call this a probability. Here's the same probability. Once you had them in commodities in 2008 and the hard hit, then there was a probability of a great financial bubble. Then there was the probability that it would blow out. It did, and get hit. So then the next probability is fraction, and the real price of gold going up and developing a very lengthy bull market for the gold and silver sector. And I'm looking forward to it.
Many of us here are as well. We've had several pundits on the show. You know, especially in the last 6 months, we've seen an uptick, you might say, in some of the brain power. Our brain trust are starting to get excited. Many of the folks who were bearish at the top at 2011, like yourself, and remain so for most of the ride down. Do you want to give us just some quick parting comments on what might, you know, make gold aficionados even more pleasantly surprised in 2019?
I'll tell you one thing. It is not going to be the old formula where the Fed is evil, it's going to depreciate the dollar, and gold's going to go up. No, it's going to be a post-bubble deflationary package where the real price goes up and things. So what has been happening in the long bear market since 2011, and keep in mind that this historical stuff I had then, and of course I had it way before that, but we used the silver-gold ratio for important tops, and when the momentum, the RSI on the silver-gold ratio gets up above 80, the speculation is getting dangerous, and on that one it moved to 92, and the only time it had been at 92 was at the peak in January 1980. History gave us that there'd be a long bear market for gold's real price during the long bull market, and then the silver-gold ratio gave us the exit on it. So what you have now is that a lot of the inflation bulls in the gold and silver market have been discouraged. They may have become discouraged enough to question the theory that gold only goes up when the dollar is going down. Because the other thing in a post-bubble contraction has been that the senior currency has become chronically strong relative to most things. So then it's the real price of gold that counts. So it's going to be the old school has not been right. There's a new school coming that will eventually be seen to be right, and I'm watching for this transition, but at least we have had the research that has been working through this fascinating period. So I think all of the old bulls on the old theory have been discouraged, and there will be some who have got their eyes open and will see the opportunity as it develops.
It sounds like you are a little more bullish on the yellow metal. And so will that come at the expense of U.S. equities, or will we see, you know, bull markets in tandem?
Yeah. When you're into a crash like we were in the fall, gold stocks are not going to go up. So we became bullish on November 1st, and advised buying on weakness. And there was about 3 weeks of weakness, and then they've had a nice rally, became overbought. But also, Chris, to get back to your cryptos, that is somewhere is going to be the equivalent of cash, and there will be it will have a role in the financial markets, as has gold has had a role in the financial markets. But me, I like the gold stocks to trade, and we came overbought on February 21st. And we're looking for the next entry point and intend to trade it, but we're looking at the probability of a lengthy bull market. And I think our research will identify the opportunities as they come along.
Bob Hoy, you want to give some contact information to our listeners?
Oh, sure. Just Google my name, Bobhoye, or you can put in a .com after it, and it'll get you into our website.
You also have access to Mr. Clark's technical analysis there as well.
It's Ross Clark and our institutional advisors. We've got a whole lot of things under here, but the research has been reliable.
Isn't that just important? We need reliability when it comes to our market prognosticators. Bob Hoy, thank you so much.
Good. We'll talk again, Chris. Look forward to it.
The blockchain revolution is transforming the global arena, disrupting every industry in its path. GoldSeek.com is excited to introduce an off-the-chain opportunity in digital gold and silver from our friends at Atmex and Sprott.com. OneGold holds physical gold and silver metals at the Royal Canadian Mint, the first online marketplace to offer secure and convenient buying, selling, and redemption of digital precious metals. OneGold uses Vault Chain, a secure, immutable blockchain ledger developed by Tradewind Markets, the leading innovator in digital precious metals distributed ledger and blockchain technology.
Vault Chain. Gold and silver are 100% redeemable through One Gold for physical precious metals delivered to customers' doors in any size at competitive prices and low transaction storage costs. As a special offer and for a limited time only, One Gold is offering gold and silver at spot price with no additional premiums. OneGold.com is secure and accessible 24/7 on any device, offering convenient purchases and sales of precious metals. Easy recurring transactions make passive saving and gold dollar cost averaging as easy as a single mouse click. Vault Chain offers the best tier pricing on AppMex products, setting the industry standard as a fully backed physical asset with easy redemption in coins, rounds, or bars, offering clients peace of mind and full transparency. Don't get left behind. Remember to bookmark OneGold.com for the safest and most convenient digital precious metals today. Remember, OneGold.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. I must say that I concur with the president's recent tweet in which he said making daylight saving time permanent is okay with me. Leaving daylight savings in the on position year-round is a good idea. Less use of artificial light in the evenings, more hours of natural light later in the day to cut down some degree of driving in the dark. It all adds up to good common sense. But now that the president has endorsed his support of permanent daylight savings time, it might be safe to assume that opposition forces will now surface and challenge his fitness and authority to make such statements. After all, he may not have the requisite scientific background to comment on such things. Hearings may need to be convened, experts consulted, subpoenas issued. If Congress doesn't address the issue, and then the president were to issue an executive order, no doubt it would be challenged in federal court. Then it could be fast-tracked to the Supreme Court. Is it possible Justice Kavanaugh would be the deciding vote on such a matter? If he voted to support a permanent switch to daylight savings time, collusion would be alleged. Claims would surface that extra daylight could somehow sway or influence voters one way or another. A new special counsel would have to be appointed. Obstruction of justice would be alleged because a permanent switch to daylight savings time would mess up the timing and have a negative impact on those early morning pre-dawn raids where documents that used to be protected by attorney-client privilege are seized. Then the media will begin planting the suggestion of a constitutional crisis, claiming they are not driving such rhetoric, but rather simply reflecting the will of the people. Does this process sound familiar? It's like being stuck in a negative feedback loop in a really bad video game. Substitute any topic you like for daylight savings time, and you have the essence of today's political climate. We've already experienced lots of these things in relation to other topics as the public's desensitization continues to grow. But under no circumstances can claims of a constitutional crisis ever be allowed to turn in to an actual constitutional convention. Constitutional conventions are for grown-ups, like those who founded this great country. Like no other time before us, we now have the equivalent of grown children who have been elected to the halls of Congress. Lots of whiners, lots of complainers, and a diminishing number of problem solvers. Remember, under no circumstances can claims of a constitutional crisis ever be allowed to turn into an actual constitutional convention. If that were to happen, the Republic would be gutted and lost. Our mixed economy of some capitalism and some socialism would transform into totalitarianism literally overnight. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.